I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether that's a hike up the mountains, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute pamper session, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. This season, I've teamed up with Sally Hansen. Sally Hansen herself was more than a beauty innovator and businesswoman. She believed in the importance of self-care all the way back in the 1930s. Sally Hansen believes that beauty is better when you do it yourself. So this summer, why not get a salon finish on your nails with Miracle Gel and a perfect flawless tan with the iconic Airbrush Lex Tan. And just like Sally herself, enjoy every self-caring moment of it. This week on the Good Glow podcast, I speak to Erica Cody. Erica is a singer and songwriter, and over the last couple of weeks has been educating us all on what it's like to be black and Irish. She has inspired us and created positive change, and I'm so grateful to her for coming onto my podcast today. I felt so strongly in my heart that I wanted to do a podcast to understand racism better and use my platform for the greater good. It's so important for us all to take a step back at this time and listen. I have learned so much over the last couple of weeks and want to continue on this path. Thank you for listening. Now over to Erica. Erica, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
Thank you so much. Honestly, massive fan. Always have been of this podcast. I love the space that you create. It's just so wholesome.
Thank you so much. And it was so lovely to meet you today. And we were just speaking before we came on air about this podcast and the platform that I have and how I want to use my voice. And since the killing of George Floyd, I have been trying to educate and listen, listen to stories coming from America, listen to black people in Ireland. And there was a part of me that was like, I really want to do a podcast with Erica, but are people going to think that I'm jumping on a bandwagon? Yeah. And I had many sleepless nights because My heart was telling me that I had to do this, but there was a little part of me that was like, it doesn't affect me. Say nothing. You're better off saying nothing. But actually, I think we've come to a point in 2020 where it's not good enough to turn your head the other way because it doesn't affect you.
Yeah.
It's time for us all to make this our business and to learn. So 100%. That's just what I wanted to say at the start of the podcast. I'm a little bit nervous.
It's okay. Don't be nervous. This is a really important conversation to have. And it's been a conversation that I think a lot of people of colour and a lot of black people have been wanting to have, to feel the acceptance of people wanting to listen and being willing to learn, because I know a lot of our experiences have stemmed from mainly ignorance most of the time, but also people diminishing our stories and not actually, you know, being willing to just listen. Because this isn't an issue that you just kind of pull up out of nowhere. It's been so deeply rooted all over the world, especially in the States. You know, I've noticed the difference between racist America and racist Ireland is that they're two totally different places. Because in racist America, they've built their country on racism. And now it's gotten to a point that it has to be rebuilt, like all the way back down to its foundations. But here it's mainly from a place of ignorance, luckily, because I've noticed a lot of the experiences that I've had, a lot of people have been willing to listen and try to understand, but it's been amplified more now because everybody now feels comfortable to talk about it. This is an issue that, like, I haven't even felt comfortable to talk about with some family members sometimes, or, you know, I know I can, you know, really just speak to my dad about it because he's black and his family are black and they get it if I just want to rant about, you know, the experience. But yeah, it's just one of those things that it's like, okay, we're tired. We're really tired from, you know, explaining the same situations all the time. And it comes, your brain is kind of conditioned in a way to where you're nearly just expecting the worst. That's how I've found it anyway, because with everything that happened with, like, the murder of George Floyd, it brought up a lot of trauma for me that I didn't deal with when I was a kid. That's like physical and emotional racial abuse that I'd felt. So Yeah, it really just brings up a lot. So I think when it comes to this issue, it's just important now that people have time to listen, especially with what's going on in the world. Everyone's just trying to do the right thing, I feel. So it's just really about, you know, taking those extra steps to educate yourself. Listen to a podcast, watch a YouTube video, watch Netflix. You know, it's all at the palm of our hands, and people just really have to, you know, tune in, because now is the time. This isn't like, this conversation isn't really going to go anywhere. Like, it's not going to stop.
That's what I keep hearing again and again and again, mm-hmm. is we are tired of this. Mm-hmm. And somebody, I think it was on Oprah's podcast, the one she did, Where Do We Go From Here,
yeah.
on her Super Soul Conversations. And it was, we are tired of mm-hmm. seeing the same thing happen again and again, having the same conversations again and again, and yeah. nothing changes. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like we're at a point now where something might change?
It has to change, and it's, no one's going to rest until there is change. I know I feel that way. It's like, I don't feel like I can even release my new music or anything now, because I'm like, I don't want to do anything for my own gain. If anything, I want to just use the platform that I'm given and the opportunities I'm given to give this issue a voice, give it an extra voice that can be amplified here, especially because I know I'm not the only one who feels that way. And if I can, you know, use my platform in that way to talk about an issue that I've been talking about for years and it's only being listened to now, I'm happily going to do that.
Wow. And tell us a little bit then about what life was like for you growing up.
Well, yeah, so I grew up, I'm mixed race. So my dad's black, he's African-American, and my mom is white. She's Irish. So my dad came over here in the 80s. He was a professional basketball player. So in the 80s, it was a massive game here. You know, there was a lot of Americans that just came over straight either out of the NBA or just from the draft. So the caliber of athletes that were coming over here were next level, and basketball was at such a pinnacle here. So when my dad came over here in the 80s, from what he tells me is that, you know, they were seen as celebrities. They weren't seen as the people who came over, who had emigrated here to study in the Royal College of Surgeons. They got two totally different, you know, perceptions. So it's like, it's weird in a sense, because it's like, oh, I'm kind of delighted he didn't face so much racism. Now, he did face a lot, and I've experienced it with him. But just because of where he was from, it nearly kind of gave him a pass, which I still find really strange. Like, I remember being in a taxi with him one day, and he'd just gotten a new TV, and we'd get like an 8-seater TV. I think I was only about 7 or so at the time, and the taxi man didn't speak to him for the whole journey. And at the time, like, I was getting heavily bullied for the colour of my skin. I'd come home, I'd scream crying, I just want to wash it all off, I can't take it anymore. I'd rob my mum's razors from the age of 7 to rub my Ronnie off and everything. So yeah, it was a lot. It brought up a hell of a lot. So experiencing it with my dad firsthand so young, it nearly becomes like this new normal, which it shouldn't. And I just remember the taxi man didn't say anything to him for like the whole taxi ride. And my dad was going to pay him to give him the money. And he goes, oh, Jesus, you're American. Sorry, I thought you were Nigerian. And it's like things like that. But I'm like, there's one Nigerian girl in my school. Why is that a bad thing? Like, she's the same color as my dad. And I'm black too, but I'm just a lighter complexion. So yeah, things like that don't go away. Mm. The slurs don't go away. The physical abuse doesn't go away either, you know, and it's things that it takes something so horrible, like a modern day lynching of Robert Fuller or George Floyd, especially, to literally have people be like, oh my God, racism is still here. And it's like, we've been living this for years. And I'm still fighting. Well, I'm trying to fight for what my dad has fought for, my aunties have fought for, my grandmother, her mother, her mother's mother, and her mother's mother, who would have came from slavery. Like, that's how far back, you know, the line goes. And it's affected our family in the States personally as well, because my family's in South Carolina. They're all black. I have lots of black male cousins who I'm really close to, my first cousins, second cousins. And this topic has brought up a lot of more questions for me, especially with the situation we're in globally now. It's, you know, it's really kind of caused people to just stop. And it's given me a lot of time to reflect. But when all this came up, it was like a whole different type of reflection. I was like, I need to know more. I need to learn more, because I feel like I've just kind of silenced myself sometimes from learning, because it's exactly, you're just exhausted from talking about the same thing. So I was on to my auntie, she's amazing, and we were just having like these really long conversations, a lot of tears, there was a lot of crying, and we couldn't really get on the phone without, you know, just breaking down. My heart was breaking for her, like I know her heart was breaking for what was going on in her country. So I just remember her saying to me, she was like, Erica, like, this has affected our family, you know, like your great grandfather was shot and killed by a policeman, by a white policeman at a baseball game. He was an umpire. And then my third cousin was shot and killed by a white cop as well at a traffic stop 12 years ago. So I never had the pleasure to meet him. But like hearing these stories can only light this fire under you. It's something that I've never really felt before. Like, yes, I've wrote songs about it and stuff about my own experiences, but this just kind of, it brought it to a whole nother level. And I think that goes across the board for everyone. It was this, it's this new sense of, okay, we really need change now, because this isn't going to stop. So I think definitely watching like the likes of the 13th on Netflix highlights how messed up the prison system is in America, and how it's basically just modern day slavery and it hasn't changed. Like, slavery hasn't gone away, it's just been reformed. So it's quite insane. But in a way, I'm really blessed that, you know, I live here, that I was brought up here, that I was born here. Because growing up, like, it wasn't really about, my dad never really told me about his experiences with racism. He would have just told me his experiences here with racism, because that was going to ring true with me someday. And I was already experiencing it from such a young age. Like my nana, my mother's mom, she's my absolute angel. But she was saying to me, obviously this brought up a lot of conversations for the two of us, like my little niece, she's mixed race as well. So it just brought up a lot. And she was like, Erica, like, I remember from you as young as the age of two having it in your pram, and women literally shouting across the street being like, Jesus, not another black baby. So it's like, and what frustrates me is that, like, okay, if I can face that, what's the next person who has a darker complexion facing? Because I'm being told to be shipped back on a boat to Africa, you know? And it's like, I can't even begin to imagine what, you know, because everyone's stories are so different. And I guarantee, if you meet any other person of color, they'd say the exact same thing, that they had some sort of racial abuse at some point in their life, you know?
That's the thing, you're not going to meet a black person that hasn't experienced it, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
But that is the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm. And when you're speaking to your relatives in South Carolina, has life changed for them over the last couple of months? Is like, what's going on there?
Yeah. And it's like, when I saw the video of George Floyd, I didn't just see him. Like, I saw my dad going back to visit my grandmother. I saw my cousins, you know, I'm really close with her, only 2 years older than me. I saw my little brother, who's five, and his mother is Spanish, and my dad is black. So like, it's just, I saw my sister, I saw my aunties, I saw literally everyone. And when I was talking to my aunt about I still can't even get on the phone to talk to my grandmother, because I just know I won't be able to keep my stuff together. But when I was talking to my aunt, I was like, how are you? And she's like, well, I'm not okay, and I'm afraid to get in my car to go to work in case I come across the wrong person on the wrong day. She's told me about stories years and years ago, not that long ago, I would have been alive. And her driving, like taking the back roads to drive up to North Carolina and coming, like praying to herself that she doesn't get a flat tire when she's driving through a KKK rally. And they still happen to this day. She drove past them the other day. She told me, but she just said they're not as big as they were back then. But that constant, like, living in fear because of the colour of your skin, that's why we're in 2020 now. Like, I'm sure years ago we would have been like, sure, we're meant to be driving flying cars by now. But instead, we're still battling issues like racism.
I was listening to Oprah's podcast, and there was a man on it, and he just said, like, the casual nature of this police officer, the sunglasses on the head. And Blind Boy actually said it on his podcast, that we need to be careful about resharing the videos of violence and of George Floyd's death, because it's bringing up real trauma in people.
Well, that's
like
it,
what you said, like that could be my dad.
Literally, yeah. And it's like, I keep hearing, like, myself especially saying to people, have these uncomfortable conversations, watch the video, because black people have been watching these videos for, since Trayvon Martin, all of that was caught on a 911 call. But still hearing and seeing these things happen, and it only takes for it to happen to George Floyd this year for people to be like, this is really bad. It's the, I just really can't believe that we've just become so desensitized to racism, and it's become so normal to see another black person being killed in the street for people to just be like, oh wow, this is bad. And then for people here to say that, like, oh, like, that doesn't affect us here. It's like, that's privilege in itself, is because it hasn't affected you directly. It's like, all we need you to do is just listen to what we have to say, and possibly, hopefully, you'll learn something from what we have to say. Because if there's anything that I've learned a lot from throughout this whole experience, is that I didn't really know much about privilege. And it's really kind of made the whole conversation around racism, it's made me understand it more, because I'm like, why are people so ignorant towards, I don't understand. And I'm like, oh my god, there you go, it comes from privilege, because it's never affected them. The people who challenge it have never been affected by it.
And it's also the colour blindness. So yeah. My husband said the other day, sure, you know, because I'm worried that Pia isn't mixing with black kids, and I'm trying to buy her black dolls, and you know, I'm just trying to make her understand that not everybody has blonde hair and blue eyes.
Yeah.
And Jamie said, sure, my best friend is married to a black woman, and Pia plays with the kids all the time. And I said, who? Like, I forgot for a minute.
Yeah.
But then I started to learn about colour blindness, and it's actually not good enough that I look at Nicolene and don't see her colour, because I need to see her colour too.
I'm so happy you said that.
Because, tell us about that.
Yeah, the amount of times that I've had people say, but like, and it comes from a genuine place, because these are people that have been around me my whole life. They're like, Erica, like, we just see it for you. We don't see it any other way. And it's like, I know you don't, but I've started to understand the whole colour blindness thing too as well. And it's like, but I kind of want you to see my colour, because it's not easy. Yeah, I'm mixed race and I have certain privileges. Like, if I go out with my white family, I won't be looked at the same way as maybe the next person who's sitting on the next table and they're a black family. Do you know what I mean? So it's this constant, it's a bit of a battle being mixed race, because I know when I was growing up, it was like, well, you're not black enough and you're not white enough, and you're sitting there and you're at like the young age of 8 and you're like, well, what am I? Like, who am I? You don't even know yourself. It took me to be in my teens for me to understand, or try to understand, who I am, and to wear my hair down. I used to never wear my hair down. I hated my hair down. The handful of times I actually did wear my hair down in primary school was for my communion and my confirmation. And I think everything else after that was like, absolutely not. I'm not doing it. And it would always be, you know, my mom saying, Erica, your curls are so beautiful. People would die for your curls. Like, you're so unique. You've this amazing head of hair. Like, show it off. I didn't get that at the time. I was just so used to, you know, going into school, some people pulling my hair, calling me a monkey, making monkey noises at me every day in school, making fun of my facial hair because my hair is darker. So it was like that. It was the constant battle of just wanting to fit in. That's all. I just wanted to be able to coexist with everyone. And a lot of the time, no one would stand up. Like, I'm still experiencing some of the same things I experienced in primary school that I'm experiencing now. People going past me on their bike and touching my hair or grabbing my hair or asking me, where am I from? I tell them Baldoyle, or I tell them the north side, and they say, oh no, but like, where are you really from? And it's like, I have the luxury of knowing where I'm really from. I have the luxury of having this direct line with my family in South Carolina, learning about my history. My grandmother's a walking history book, and so is my dad. And it's like, I know there's so many other people who have come from positions where they didn't know anything about where they're from. Like, there was a story on the Black and Irish page where all the stories of Black and Irish people are shared. And there was one of this lady, and she was born in a Magdalen laundry, and she's only started to really understand now where she's coming from. And I think when you're constantly told that year after year, day after day, like, you just get so exhausted. And it's happened to me in work when I was working in retail. It was literally only me and I'd say three other black people working there. And it's like, I had a woman come in to me and say, oh, you're gorgeous. And I was like, oh, thank you. And she goes, yeah, where'd you get your tan from? And I was just like, oh, here we go again. I remember I was just kind of at my wit's end at this point. I thought I just kind of hit a wall. I was like, why is my Irish just constantly being questioned or being diminished? And she went off, and then she came back and she goes, yeah, where are you from? And I was like, I'm from Dublin. And she goes, all right, okay. She walked off again. She came back. She said, yeah, but like, where are you actually from? And I said, I was actually born around the corner in the Rotunda. I hope you have a lovely day. And I left it at that. And I remember just coming home and writing a song about it. And then that's when my single, Where You're Really From, came.
Wow. And tell us about your music, because it's amazing.
Oh, thank you. Back to the story of my dad coming over here. I think I was constantly juggling basketball and music. I think it was inevitable that, you know, my two parents were extremely sporty. I was one of those kids that they kind of just threw into everything. I was doing basketball, tennis. My mom was a gymnast and a squash player, so I was doing squash and tennis. My grandparents played tennis as well. So I think I just come from a really sporty family, so they always wanted to make sure that I was busy. Luckily, I'm very, very blessed that I had the opportunity to do all those things. But I just remember it was like a constant battle of juggling so much. And it kind of got to the point in my teens where I was loving basketball. I was loving music. Like, I was in stage school and stuff since the age of like 3. And the only other person I had to look up to in the media was Samantha Mumba. There was nobody else on covers of magazines, nothing else. That was who I'd be getting compared to from the age of like 4, because she was the only other mixed race Irish woman who was doing music and dancing and doing all that kind of stuff. So I actually had like the pleasure to meet her, and I was like, oh my God, like, I don't really get starstruck, but when I met her, I was like, oh my God, like, you're the person I had to look up to here. Like, I'm so happy to meet you, like, in the flesh. So yeah, I met her, and then, yeah, just the juggling basketball and music, sorry. I got into my mom was diagnosed with cancer when I was 10. So I spent a lot of time with my dad. It was a lot of weekends spent with him, a lot of weeks. I was only used to spending weekends with my dad. And then obviously when my mom, you can't, you know, be around your kids or anything. So I spent a lot of time. It was my new normal. Mm. So I started journaling. I started writing poems. It was this new way I found to express myself. So I remember after I was writing like all these poems, I got a guitar for my 10th birthday, my 9th or 10th birthday. And I just remember these poems like slowly starting to become songs, and I started to really find my voice then. And it was like basketball for me was an outlet, and my music was my therapy. And that's why whenever I'm kind of going through a hump, I always kind of go back to that place and remember why I started doing what I was doing. I'm just lucky to be doing it in the way that I am now and getting to perform in front of thousands of people. So all that time, you know, away and like reflecting from like the age of 10, I think I was really distracted as well. I didn't really know what was going on, because I was like, oh, my mom, she can do anything. Like, she's gonna get through this. Thank God she did. So it was like I was playing basketball into my late teens then, sorry. I was playing basketball 5 nights a week, and then games in the weekend. Like, it was my life. And the thing is with basketball is that you don't get paid for it here. It's, you literally just do it for the love of the game, and you get to play at this high level and travel. So it's like, do you know what? I'm with all my best friends. I really couldn't care. I don't have time to go out drinking. I don't have time to do this. So I was just really committed from a really young age with music and basketball, and I was constantly juggling the two. So then when it got to like my late teen, well, when I went over to America, sorry, we went over in, I think I was in third year, because I remember I was just about to do my junior cert. And my dad was like, you know, you can really come over here for the year, for your transition year, if you wanted to play and go to high school here for a year. And I was like, I don't really know what to do. Am I ready to leave home? I don't know. And obviously, the first time I went over, for the first time since I was a baby, I was 14, 15. And it was a mad culture shock for me too, because I'm not used to being in a predominantly black neighborhood or state, coming from Ireland, which is predominantly white, and we're a really small minority here. So I was like, this is crazy. I loved it, but I was like, this is madness. Like, you forget that there's a whole other world over here. So I remember going over, and I came back, And I was just like, I don't know if I'm ready to take this jump. I just don't know if I'm ready yet. And I think it's because I always knew at the end of the day I was really going to stick to music. And I think me always saying to my dad that, like, look, yeah, I might think of going to America to play, going to college or whatever, because he was really trying to, you know, help make that happen for me, because I really was trying to go to the States for college. I was talking to my guidance counsellor about it. Like, she was telling me how to go about it, if I was to get like financial aid or whatever the case may be, or to get, if I was to get a full ride scholarship for basketball. And just the way that I was playing it in my head, my dad was like, yeah, like, you're well, if he, him not being biased as well, he was like, I see your talent, I know you can do it. And I was just kind of like, yeah. And it was some of those things that came naturally to me. And I was like, I don't know if it's what I really want to do, I don't know if it's my dream. So I remember BIM had just, BIM was only open, I'd say, 2 years or so. It's the music college. And it runs in coalition with DIT, so that's where you get your degree from. So I was looking into all this with my music teacher. I absolutely loved my music teacher, Miss Heffernan. She was amazing. She really kind of, you know, got the fire started in me to really, you know, start pursuing it. So I remember I applied for BIM, did my audition, did really well in my audition. And I was still playing basketball. So I was like, okay, in a way, I have the best of both worlds here. You know, I get to still play Super League at a National League level, and I get to do music and get my degree for it. So in a way, and I have so much time to grow as well. Because if I was in America, I wouldn't have had time to, you know, when you're on a full ride scholarship, it's like you're in the gym all the time. You're working out all the time. I wouldn't have had, music wouldn't have gotten a look in. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was like, this is the best scenario that I can be in, possibly. So that's kind of just where it all started. And then, yeah, I got injured. It was like the first quarter of like a quarter final. And I was at this point now, I think it was literally my body talking to me, because I was juggling. Like, I look back now and I'm like, how did I do it? I was going from gigs to training, or from training to gigs. And then there's the whole thing of, like, you know, trying to, you're around, like, you're finally around so many like-minded people. It was like a playground of musicians and opportunities. And it was just, it was getting really hard to juggle, because I'm so torn, because I love these two things so yeah. much, and they bring me so much joy, and they've gotten me through so much. But it kind of came down to the point, it was like, right, okay, what's going to make me, what can I do with my passion that's going to make me a living? And that was music. So then, yeah, I tore my ACL in the inner quarterfinal. I was 18. And then that was the end of it. I had 9 months rehab recovery to learn how to walk, skip, jump, bend my knee again. It was horrific. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Really invasive surgery. So yeah, I remember just thinking to myself, after I woke up from the operation or whatever, and I just came around, I was just thinking to myself, because I had a lot of time to myself, because I had to stay, I remember to stay overnight, and I remember just thinking to myself, I was like, right, what am I going to do? What am I going to do now? What can I do for the next 9 months to keep myself occupied while I'm still going to rehab and stuff? And then that's just when I really just started kind of getting the ball rolling with music and doing more gigs, taking any gig that came my way. And like, I'd been at music seriously from like the age of 15, 16. I did my first support slot when I was 16 for WizKid and City West. And for me, that was like, okay, this is, it just gave me a feeling. I felt so comfortable. For the first time, I think, in my life, I was like, wow, people are actually, they want to listen, they want to hear. And it just kind of, it just made me feel really alive. So I remember when I did that, I was like, that was the first time I was like, this is what I want to do. And then obviously when I got injured, that was, you know, the world just telling me to, you know.
The universe bringing you down a different path.
It was literally the universe talking to me. So I was like, right, okay, we're going to do this.
It's amazing, because to have like two talents
so
that
lucky.
People would just love to have, like, I went to Beaufort, and we, like your dad, yeah. Our basketball coach came over to Ireland in the 80s, Kelvin Troy.
Kelvin Troy's my dad's best friend.
No way.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
way. So he was our basketball coach, and he used to kick our arses.
Yeah.
Used to make us do all of these like runs up down, and we were like in first year, you know, we'd be dead.
Remember my dad literally making me and like all my cousins run laps around Fairview Park when we, for I think it was for like my 9th birthday.
Oh my god.
Yeah, we woke up, we were all having a sleepover, there's 9 in the family, so all the girls stayed over, there were 7 of them, and he brought us over to the park the next morning. It was like, right, let's go, get your gear on, we're going for it. That's what it was like. It was discipline, and that's what I loved about basketball, is the discipline yeah. that it came with. I didn't have time for the weekends to be going out drinking with my mates or any of that kind of stuff. That was once in a blue moon.
Yeah.
If I got to go to a party. So it'd be like, oh, Erica can't come. She's playing basketball.
Because I think that's, we were so scared of Kelvin, because if we were late, or, you know, if you put a foot out of line,
yeah,
you know, you'd have to like run for 20
or
minutes.
Whatever, yeah.
And I remember he really taught us discipline. Like, we only had him for 2 or 3 years and then we got a new coach.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget him. He's an amazing guy. How is he?
Amazing. He's really good. He's really good. I'm in contact with his daughters a lot as well, you know, because like all these guys that came over, it was nearly to a point that like, okay, every American that came over is more likely still here or somewhere in Europe. And a lot of the kids they had, like we all would have grown up together. So it was like nearly most of the mixed race kids in Dublin were coming from all the guys who came over in the 80s. So like I still keep in contact with a lot of them. Like I'm really, like there was the Black family. I literally grew up with them. You know, we were raised as cousins. You know, if we had each other, we were grand.
Yeah.
You know, because there wasn't many Black kids or mixed race kids. So we were always grown up to, we were brought up together, you know, as cousins. Like still to this day, we're cousins or sisters, you know. So
amazing.
That's, and there's 9 of them in their family. So it was always, that's where my weekends were, my Christmases and everything else.
Wow.
Yeah.
And tell us then about when the protest in Dublin, like was there even a question of you going to that?
Yeah. I think that, so that weekend, I think it was the Friday, I think I saw the video of George Floyd, and I just remember not being able to stop crying, and it was a way that I hadn't felt in, I can't even remember the last time I felt that way. It was just this really deep sadness, and I know that goes for everyone in the Black community. They felt the exact same way, because it just brings up everything. It like nearly makes you just have to think about everything that you faced. So I remember seeing the video. It was a really, it was just crying nonstop, sporadically, like throughout the day. It was mental. And I remember calling my dad, and I was like, Dad, did you see the video of George Floyd? And he was like, no. But I was like, okay, he's probably sick and tired of seeing these things all the time. And I feel like I'm feeling what he's feeling on a different level. Mm. So yeah, when I saw that, I was kind of like, okay, this isn't okay. This just isn't okay anymore. I'm sick of seeing these videos happening all the time. Breonna Taylor died and Ahmaud Arbery died within, I think it was 2 weeks of each other. And I remember seeing those videos, well, the one of Ahmaud Arbery, and I was just like, why is this still happening? Why? I don't understand how someone can go out in their truck and shoot a Black man down for going jogging, and he's 25. And then George Floyd has a police officer's knee on his neck and he's killed. So I just remember it really just kind of lit a fire under me in a way. And I was like, okay, what can I do to help? Because I know my family aren't okay. And I'm all the way over here. I can't be with them. I don't know when I'm going to get to be with them next with everything that's going on in the world. So I remember a friend of mine, JLOL, really talented rapper, he had put up a poster of a protest. And I was just like I didn't even question it. I just shared it and I was like, see you tomorrow. And that was on the Sunday. And keep in mind, I was like, oh my God, like I'm high risk. My granddad's high risk. But I'm still fighting for racism. Like it wasn't a question, but it was, because I was like, okay, I need to be really careful going to this. But at the same time, it's like, it was all for a good reason. You know, the beaches have been packed for weeks. No one had been talking about that. So it was like, it was easy to give out about a Black Lives Matter protest, but you know, no one was looking at the thousands of people on Portmarnock Beach the next day. So for me, it was really important, and it wasn't only important for me, it was important for everyone, because this isn't just a Black people problem, this is a humanitarian problem.
And when you were going to the protest then, how did you feel? Obviously, there was so many emotions.
Yeah, well, I was really anxious, first of all. My anxiety had kind of gone through the roof with everything that was going on. I hadn't left my house. I'd only go out once a week to do the shop for me and my granddad. And that was it. So I think having to get out for such an important cause, it made me anxious, but it also, there's no right or wrong time to protest. Like, people are angry and people are really tired, and it was something that had to be done. And I feel really passionate about that. I'll always say that, you know, racism. So it was, it's easy for people to say to me, oh, but like, yeah, I get it, but why now? And it's like, you don't, you can't sit here and tell me why now. I've been experiencing racism my whole life. The next person has too. Just try and channel that energy elsewhere and try and look inward and educate yourself instead of constantly questioning people, because we've been being questioned for years. So that was my point of where I was coming from. But yeah, I was really anxious, but at the same time I was like, we're so ready for change, this has to happen now, there's no other time than now. Like, it wasn't good enough for me to wait and go on Saturday, which was the next planned protest. I had, like, for me personally, I just had to get out and just, you know, fight for these rights again and fight for my people, which is mental. But I remember when I had shared it, the poster, like, I had like 10,000 or so followers, and I remember when I started really talking about this, I thought it would have went the opposite way. I thought people would have, you know, been falling off and didn't want to listen. And then within like 2 days, there had been 10,000 people that had followed me. But when I shared the poster, it had over 8,000 likes and like 16,000 shares. Like, it was mental. And that was the first time I had ever seen numbers on Instagram show up in person. Like, no, I don't think anybody had anticipated the crowds that came, because, you know, we obviously all had social distance, and, you know, most people there who were being safe were wearing masks. I know I was wearing a mask, I was trying to keep my distance when we could, but obviously it was impossible to do at times because of the numbers. But yeah, it was just one of those things. I was like, I can't sit at home, I can't talk about this and not go out and really be a part of it. So it was just, it was just really important for me, and I know there's a lot of people who feel the same.
And then how do you feel then when you see white people at the protest?
It gives me so much hope. Like, it really does. And it's like, because for so long you're like, oh, they're not going to listen to me. To then seeing so many people come and stand in solidarity, like, it was really overwhelming. There was a lot of tears that were shed from everyone that were there. It was really powerful. But the thing is, why I feel so lucky to have lived here as well. I know the racism and stuff has been awful, but at the same time, we're really lucky because Ireland is still so young, and to see what I have nothing but hope that we really can, you know, get through this if people, you know, keep the conversation up and really want to learn. It is possible, because seeing what we've achieved in the last 5 years with our two referendums, our gay marriage referendum and our abortion referendum, Irish people are ready for change too. You know, we're very progressive, and I definitely feel like now is the now and next year and the times after that are all going to be about progression and what can we do to make where we live better. So I just think it's, you know, it was really amazing to see so many people stand in solidarity for what was going on with the Black Lives Matter movement, because you automatically, as I was saying, like, your brain is conditioned in a way that you're like, oh God, like, I'm going to have this conversation again, or are they going to listen? Am I going to be questioned? So just knowing that people are literally willing and ready. And I have to say, like, thank you to like the parents and teachers who have reached out to me by saying, thank you for sharing what you've shared. I just need you to know that I'm doing everything I can in my classroom to make my classroom more diverse and talk about these things with kids and, you know, the appropriate way or whatever. And parent, like, it all starts at home, and it starts in school, and it starts in the workplace. You know, brands have been wondering how to, you know, become more diverse. It's like, champion diversity then, you know, hire people of colour. They're all there. You just have to look. I can't even tell you how many times when I was starting out, like, doing modelling and stuff, I'd show up on a shoot, no one could do my makeup because they couldn't match my skin, or my makeup would be way too light. Never mind hair, that's a whole nother story. Like, they'd never do my hair, or if they did, it would just be like abominable. Like, it wasn't a nice experience. You know, you're nearly made to feel like you're the odd one out, and they can't really do anything to help you, so you don't feel like you're getting the same experience as the next person. And these things are meant to be exciting, going on shoots and doing all this kind of stuff, but if anything, it just kind of brought me anxiety, because I remember when I'd met my makeup artist, Aisling Kelly, she's incredible, amazing makeup artist, especially with black skin. And I remember when we finally met and she did my makeup for the first time, and I was just like, okay, do you want me to give you my foundation now? And she just couldn't believe that the experience that not only I've like been accustomed to, but so many other people of colour who she works with have been like, why can't people just match your skin with foundation? I don't understand. She just couldn't wrap her head around it. And it just became like a new normal for me. Like, I'd be bringing my products for my hair onto shoots just in case. Like, I'm chugging around so much gear just in case somebody can't do my hair properly. So that's ways that people can really be innovative and hire black hairstylists. There's so many of them. Barbers, makeup artists, whatever it is, like, that's how we can make this better. Like, if you're wondering how to help, that's where it starts too.
And it's not just one podcast. It's not just one protest.
Yeah.
There needs to be change and it needs to be consistent, and we all need to make the effort.
Totally.
And tell me then what we can do better as parents to educate our children. Like, what sort of conversation should we be having?
I know. And like, I wish like I had the answers for that, even, because I appreciate everybody so much, you know, reaching out and being like, what can I do here? What can I do there? And I'm like, I'm really just trying to share, you know, what I see and, you know, to give it a bigger platform, because I'm by all means not, you know, like an educator or anything like that. I wouldn't want to even give myself titles like that. I'm just trying to, you know, use this platform in a way that, you know, people can use it as a tool to learn more, by me sharing sources and information and my own experiences. But I think it's just about, you know, knowing to stand up, being actively anti-racist and teaching that within, you know, the next younger generation. And I feel like they're going to change the world. I really do.
They really are.
Like, my little cousin, he's 11, and he called me, and this was the day, this was one of the days that I just couldn't do anything. He picked up the phone, he was like, and he's such a sweetheart. Like, he's, I don't know what we did to deserve him, but he's just so sweet. And he just said, he was like, Erica, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm okay. And he just goes, I just wanted to check in with you because I just can't believe this is still happening. Like, poor George and everything. And I just broke down. I was like, he even gets it and he's 11. Like, why can't people in their 50s or their 60s or their 70s understand this too? Or people my age even, you know? It's not hard to understand that racism is a thing. And just because it doesn't affect you directly doesn't mean that you get the privilege to turn a blind eye to it anymore.
And it's,
you know,
it's about not only being non-racist, but being anti-racist.
Anti-racist,
and that's a huge conversation at the moment. And I'd really recommend, there's a TED talk on it, the difference between being not racist and anti-racist. And Dermot Whelan, I don't know if you saw on Today FM last week.
Oh, I saw it. I was like, thank you.
It was amazing. And he said, you know what? It's not good enough to turn a blind eye anymore. We need to start calling people out. And I think that's what we can teach our kids in the playground or with their friends. You know, if they see an injustice, to use their voice.
Yeah.
And my husband, Jamie, did this huge study on Gen Z, because he used to run Spin, so we were looking at kind of the next generation coming up. And he came home and he showed it to me and he's like, Geordie, like, Gen Z are gonna make serious changes in the world.
Yeah.
And it gave me so much hope, because I was like, you know, it's scary raising a child when, you know, Donald Trump is the president of America and all of this stuff is going on, and it's really scary.
It's really
scary. When you actually study the kids now and what they won't stand for and the changes they're going to make, it makes me go, oh my God, my kid is lucky.
It's amazing. Like, that's what I mean. It's like, yes, we're in a really dark, horrible time, I feel, with everything going on in the world. But I think with every negative comes a positive, and that's always been my mantra, is that with any negative situation, you have to think of the positives that can come out of it too. What change can be made? The protests have made positive impacts as well, with the murderers of George Floyd. They were all brought to justice now. One of them got out on bail from donations. I'll never understand it. But things like that, it's like, okay, there can be a positive outcome for these 400 plus years of oppression. I'm a true believer, and I think that all starts with this generation, and most importantly the next one. I think they're the ones who are really going to be like, this is wrong. Like, we're not standing for this anymore.
I think, you know, when I asked you there, like, you know, what can we teach your kids? And of course, you don't have the like all the answers.
Yeah.
But I think standing up and telling your story is sometimes enough. Like, so when I'm doing corporate talks, like, I'm not a self-care expert.
Yeah.
All I have is my story.
That's
and that's
it.
All I can tell to try and help people, encourage them to check their breasts. But you can use your voice now to educate people in Ireland and you know, help us educate ourselves and listen.
That's it,
and
yeah.
I think, you know, if you were to go into businesses or go into schools, I think so many kids would look up to you and you would give so many people hope just because you're such a strong, beautiful, Black Irish girl. So I hope that
Thank
I can
you.
See you use your voice like that. I hope you'll get to go into schools and, you know, if that was something you were interested in, I think you'd be so good at it.
Yeah.
And isn't it weird how, like you said, like, you're not really focusing on your music at the moment because this is what you're passionate about right at this minute.
Right
this
now,
is
yeah.
all you can think about.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure that will come into your music down the line too.
Yeah, well, I've just spent like the last couple of weeks especially. Well, actually, since the start of lockdown, I was like, right, okay, I'm going to write a song a day. I'm gonna have like an EP or something by the end of this whole lockdown. I'll have a bank of like 50 songs. Absolutely not. I don't know why I even thought about putting that kind of creative pressure on myself in the middle of a pandemic, cocooning, when I can't experience life.
And all you're doing is going to like spa once a week.
Literally, I was like, I can't get inspired by putting a mask on and going to Lidl and doing the weekly shop. Like, I can't. That's not what I've written about. I write from, you know, life experiences, relationships, all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I really don't know why I could put that kind of pressure on myself. So I took the time at the start of the lockdown to just do the things that I enjoy because they spark inspiration for me as well. Because you get so caught up when you're so busy, you get so caught up in what's next, when's this shoot, when's this interview, and it's like you don't actually have time to focus on yourself and do what you love. That could be me going and bringing my dog to the groomers and going for a walk or whatever the case may be, or sitting on my laptop for hours playing The Sims because I haven't gotten to play The Sims since I was about 12. Things like this that used to bring me joy, I was, you know, going back to and just trying to enjoy because I didn't have any pressure. Pressures for tires. I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to meet any deadlines. So I think I really just kind of took a backseat for a while, for about a month or so. And then all this started happening and I was like, wow, I actually have a lot to talk about that I didn't realize I had to talk about. And now, because that's always, it goes back to, you know, me being able to express myself through writing. So I was offered in the Examiner, the Irish Examiner, I did Louise O'Neill's. She reached out to me and was like, I was going to write something about the Black Lives Matter movement, but it just doesn't feel right. I'd love to give you my space to write. And I was like, okay, I have to do this because this is a new audience that I obviously have to reach out to and share my story so they can maybe, you know, but share it in a way that they can hopefully relate. But when I was doing it, I didn't realize how hard it would be to do it, because when I was writing it, I was like, okay, this isn't like writing a song at all, this is really hard. And that's why, like, that whole week I just couldn't get back to everyone. I just kind of felt like everything was kind of flooding on top of me, and this was one of those things I was like, no, I have to get it done. I did three things that week. That was the 6 o'clock show, then I did the column, and then I did Louise McSherry's show that week. And I can tell you, after each of those things, I was exhausted. Like, I had to sleep for the rest of the day. It was because it's something new. Not that it's something new, but it's a very close to home topic of conversation, and it can get very overwhelming and it can get very emotional. And the reason why I was taking a backseat from it is because, just for like a couple of days or whatever, because I was like, I need what I'm saying to carry substance. I can't get overwhelmed. I can't get too emotional, even though it's really hard not to get too emotional. So I kind of just took that whole weekend then to do nothing. And then I was like, okay, I'm ready to go on Monday. And we're going to keep going. And we're going to go the day after that, the week after that, the month after that. And it's going to, I can't rest until people, and we start to see change. Because it's just time. Like, there's never been a time more so than now.
Wow, I am so incredibly grateful to you for coming in and sharing your story. And like I said at the start, like, I don't want this to seem like I'm jumping on any sort of bandwagon.
No, not at all.
And I've really just enjoyed our conversation, and
Me
getting
too.
To know you better has been amazing. And just if anyone wants to check out some podcasts, Oprah Super Soul Conversations, Where Do We Go From Here, The Daily have some great podcasts. I Want to Touch the World, and The Stories of Five Protesters, I really enjoyed that one. And then TED Talks Daily obviously have podcasts all the time. So is there any books that you could recommend to my listeners?
Emma Dabry. Don't Touch My Hair.
Okay.
I remember seeing, so when I released my song last year, it was off my EP, Leoness, and it was called Where Are You Really From. It was the last song to go onto the EP, so it all kind of happened very quick. But I remember when we had announced the single was coming out, I'd just come across, it was like the pre-sale for Emma Dabbery's book of Don't Touch My Hair, and the whole message I had behind Where You're Really From was Don't Touch My Hair. I had like a little campaign video and stuff for it as well. It was like the angle I was coming at it from was don't touch my hair, don't touch my story, because there's so many people that can relate, whether they're part of the LGBTQ plus community, and vice versa. If you've ever had any sort of real struggle, I wanted it to be this space where people were like, don't touch my hair, don't touch my story, obviously relating from my struggles as a black woman. But I remember then someone had sent it to me and I was like, oh my God, the time is now. People are going to listen. But it actually just took a year after for people to be like, wow, like this is, and literally a year to the day. It's mad. But I remember I remember seeing that book and I reached out to her. I messaged her on Instagram and I was like, I just want to say like, thank you for, I haven't even gotten your book yet, but like, thank you for sharing it. I can't wait to read it. Here's my song, Where Are You Really From, if you want to have a listen. And I've been in contact with her ever since. So her book, I bought it. I started reading it at the start of lockdown and it's just fantastic. It's about cultural appropriation within black hair, because I don't think many people actually know the history of black hair and where it comes from. So it's a really important read, especially, you know, if you like braiding your hair or anything like that, or you love black hairstyles, this will tell you why to and why not to appropriate them at times. But it's a really, really amazing read and it's nonfiction, so everything in it is all sourced really well and it's like a history book. It's fantastic.
Thank you so much. And just to say, like, the last few weeks I have learned so much and I want to continue on that path. Yeah. And, you know, I'm listening loud and clear now.
Thank you so much.
I hope that somebody listening to this podcast today will feel the same way. Yeah. So thank you
I
so
also
much.
Have to say another great video is from my friend Loa.
Okay.
Oh my God, she just speaks on this like so eloquently and she broke it down really simple. She has two videos of it on Instagram. She's also a singer, Irish Sierra Leone. But she basically broke it down in a way that it was like, okay, people need to understand racism is on a spectrum. It starts with hate and it ends with death and everything else in between. So I think that's, you know, an important point to put in there. But she speaks on it really, really amazingly. I feel like the two of you would have an amazing conversation, because she talks about like what's going on in Ireland at the moment in terms of, you know, the asylum seekers living in direct provision. It's really horrific, but she's amazing. I'm still learning so much about it as well. So I think, you know, she just speaks on it so perfectly if anyone ever wants to listen to what she has to say.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Where can we find you on Instagram?
So Erica Cody and the same on Twitter and everything else. Yeah, just Google me. I just pop up.
Amazing. I can't wait to see what you do next. Best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you so much,
Georgie. Before I let you go, I just wanted to thank Erica again for being a guest on my podcast today. I wanted to make a charity donation on her behalf and she chose MASSI, the Movement of Asylum Seekers in Ireland.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast with thanks to Sally Hansen. As we all find ourselves washing our hands so much more these days, why not take better care of our nails with Sally Hansen's Cuticle Oil or Complete Care 7-in-1. You can shop the products at grocery stores and pharmacies nationwide, such as Dunn Stores and Macaulay's Health and Beauty, and online too. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. And for more on my story, you can follow me on Instagram, georgie.pulford.